So I want to talk with you today about the role of the physician, and I kind of wrote this with the idea in mind of speaking to physicians, but because I wasn't quite sure what the community was right here, the medical center applies to everybody in the medical profession and all of us who are sooner or later patients. So what I want to do is talk with you about the challenge of medicine in the age of biotechnology. Anybody who has been involved in healthcare over the past 30 years cannot help but be struck by the dramatic changes in the role of the physician. Economic pressures, demographic shifts, and the new tools and techniques of medical intervention have all driven fundamental changes, which in turn have affected the doctor-patient relationship. Even as these changes have led to a much decried loss of sensitivity and personalized care, another more subtle but significant transformation is underway. Slowly but steadily, the role of the physician as a professional guided by an overarching and enduring ethic is giving way to a new image, one of exchange, wherein the physician delivers a technical service in response to a demand driven by the patient's desires or perceived needs. This new relationship is encoded in the very language of our modern medical culture. The doctor and the patient, that's what they were called when I was trained, the doctor and the patient have now become the healthcare provider and the client. And beneath this change, propelled by the powers of our advancing biotechnology, there is a revision in the meaning of medicine. The traditional role of medicine has been to cure disease and alleviate suffering, to restore and sustain the patient to the natural level of functioning. The medical arts were in the service of a wider reverence and respect for the natural order. This idea was put succinctly by the Roman physician Galen when he said, "The physician is only nature's assistant." But now, with the powers of our advancing biotechnology, there's a new paradigm, one of liberation, technological transformation in the quest for happiness and human perfection. Consider how slowly but steadily the scope and purpose of medicine have already been extended along the gradient of our appetites and ambitions to encompass dimensions of life not previously considered matters of health, but natural human variation or limitation. From sleeping pills, to diet pills, to orthodontia, to Rogaine, growth hormone, birth control pills, liposuction, breast implants, and Viagra, and more recently, Provigil, a drug that allows you to have prolonged periods of wakefulness up to 60 hours, and Seasonale, a technological bypass to the periodicity of the menstrual cycle. In all these ways, we've altered and revised the given frame of nature. Increasingly, we've come to expect from medicine not just freedom from disease, but freedom from distress, struggle, and even the constraints of natural life processes, from all that is unattractive, imperfect, or just inconvenient. And now there are prospects for more ambitious scope, for the conquest of aging, neurologic transformations, and machine-human interfaces, and fundamental genetic revisions, and guided evolution is what some people are talking about, guided evolution of the human species for post-humans, transhumans, and techno-sapiens. All these new ideas for what medicine's supposed to be. These are summed up in the transhumanists. These are the people who are a technological extension of our species. Transhumanists, their logo is H+, humans plus. The possibilities implied by these emerging technologies have spawned a global conversation in bioethics and the search for principles and policies that can guide the applications of our new knowledge. Yet as this dialogue has deepened, it's become increasingly apparent that we must look beyond the pragmatics of pluralism and revisit the most fundamental questions concerning the very source and significance of human life. The seriousness of these questions beckons us to respectfully return to the repository of human experience and wisdom preserved in our philosophical, religious, and professional traditions. And most specifically, what they can tell us about the meaning of suffering and the highest aspirations of the human heart. A central challenge of our age becomes the search for an integrated understanding of human life that draws on both our scientific knowledge and our ethical traditions, while providing the foundation for progress, cooperation, and the defense of human dignity. If we step back from our current dilemma, we may gain a little perspective on how we got here. Isn't it interesting? Every slide is a little pink. I'm not quite sure why that is. That doesn't happen on my Mac. Anyway, you get the point. So if we go back, we look at how we got here, we can realize that we're a frontier nation forged from immigrant populations. Two currents have converged in the American identity: a radical individualism and a collective acknowledgement of the diversity of our national origins. As the 20th century unfolded, we came to recognize the amazing variability of humanity's cultural traditions. It's slowly our cultures, our traditions became kind of tribal traditions, and our clothes became costumes. And we began to see the diversity of human cultures. Challenged by this diversity, relativism replaced the certitude of convictions, and the language of rights and freedoms displaced the authority of traditional moral truths. Personal liberty and social tolerance became the paramount virtues, essential for the cohesion of a diverse but cooperative community, and these in turn distilled into a kind of lowest common denominator ethics: a basic right not to suffer, and freedom to pursue one's desires and dreams. What we called in California in the 60s, the right to do your own thing as long as it didn't hurt anybody. Remember that idea? Anyway, today, with these aspects of our social identity, there, together with them, there is a growing fascination, at least out of the Silicon Valley there is, one might say almost an infatuation with the idea of change, coupled with a sense of impatience, an imperative of immediate gratification and material progress. Fueled by technological advance across a wide front, particularly in the biosciences, medicine and its associated powers over normal, healthy human life is now drawn deeper among the positive goods and services provided by a consumer society. With the convictions of our spiritual beliefs eroded by new theories of human origins, including evolutionary psychology's purported explanation of our very motivations and sense of meaning, with all these new scientific theories eroding our traditions, we've lost confidence in the goodness of our naturally given identity and destiny. Self-acceptance gives way to a project of technological transformation in the quest for personal fulfillment. Beauty and perfection of performance become a preoccupying concern and an accepted target of medical intervention. Driven by the soft seduction of commercial persuasion and the pervasive portrayals of the ideal, broader social goals are increasingly reduced to more personal concerns with body image, a shifting valence of vanity and vulnerability. Transcendent truth is displaced as the imperatives of desire become the dominant ethical guide. The triumph of relativism culminates in complete deification of private choice as each individual becomes a culture of one. Of course, the temptations of natural desire are nothing new in human experience, but in earlier eras, constrained by our given limitations and the inescapable dependence on social community, they were entrained in the service of survival. But human beings have always dreamed of something more than health. Judging from what remains of today's pre-technological societies, potions and spiritual medical negotiation have always played a part in the quest for human completion. Our very word cosmetics comes from the Greek word cosmos, which means order, arrangement, and beauty. We seek an alignment with the deepest principles and powers of life through the resonant transformation of our physical being. Notwithstanding these pervasive expressions of the human character, at least in the traditions of the West, certain principles of professional practice came to inform and channel and constrain the use of medical intervention. With the rise of Hippocratic medicine, in the echo of an earlier emphasis on purity and holiness within Pythagorean practice, medicine was lifted to the level of a noble cause. Hippocrates dates from 460 to 370 BC. Hippocrates gave to Greek medicine both its scientific spirit and ethical ideals. Its elevated conception of the physician's calling to the care and cure of the individual patient. Although the actual Hippocratic Oath may be a later distillation of the Corpus Hippocraticum, there is little doubt that the spirit of the oath owes much to this extraordinary man. The profession of the oath binds the physician to the deepest current of accumulated medical experience and wisdom. Ethics and the art of medicine are inseparably joined. The declaration and confession of the oath is an act of dedication, a covenant to fidelity and trust in devotion to the noble purposes of medicine. The physician is neither a servant to the will of the patient nor a master over the realm of nature. The patient, as the word implies, is trustingly passive before the knowledge, caution, and exhortation of the doctor. The word doctor comes from a Latin root which means to lead or to teach. The Greek root of our word physician is phusis, which means nature. The physician is one who has knowledge of nature, the remedies. The physician discerns the parts or kinds within the whole and cooperates in aligning life with the powers of natural growth and flourishing of being. The physician is a knower of health and assists in evoking the healing capacities of the human body. His or her art is one of cooperation with the immanent organismal powers of self-healing toward a natural standard of wholeness. There is humility, and between physician and patient, a sense of unity, of shared human frailty and finitude in their common humanity. There is reverence and respect toward the healing forces that restore the natural integrity and harmony of bodily being. Moderation in what is done, prudent judgment about means, and courage to resist excessive demands are central to the task of healing, as is a certain gravity and graceful solemnity before the suffering of life and the awesome mystery of the human body. And above all, there is an affirmation of the positive principle to protect, maintain, and restore life. Medicine is a sacred and holy art. The anthropologist Margaret Mead, not generally considered to have been an ideological conservative, to say the least, Margaret Mead spoke of the revolution in medical values that marked the paradigm shift in the transition to Hippocratic medicine as, quote, one of the turning points in the history of man. She wrote, and this is all a quote, she wrote, "For the first time in our tradition, there was a complete separation between killing and curing. Throughout the primitive world, the doctor and the sorcerer tended to be the same person. He who had the power to kill had the power to cure, including specifically the undoing of his own killing activities. He who had power to cure would necessarily be able to kill. But as she explains, with Greek Hippocratism, the distinction was made clear. One profession, the followers of Asclepius, were to be dedicated completely to life under all circumstances, regardless of rank, age, or intellect. The life of a slave, the life of the emperor, the life of a foreign man, the life of a defective child. She goes on to say that Hippocratic tradition is a priceless possession which we cannot afford to tarnish. In 1974, the year of my graduation from Stanford Medical School, every student recited the Hippocratic Oath as an act of dedication, a profession of devotion to the high calling and privilege to the practice of medicine. Soon after that, the oath was replaced by the Stanford Affirmation, a modern pastiche of contemporary sentiments that leaves out entirely any mention of assisted suicide or abortion, which are both in the Hippocratic Oath. By the way, at the beginning, the Stanford Affirmation was written by each class. In other words, they could declare their own ethics, deracinated completely from the traditions of the past. Okay, well, times change, and new technologies invite altered attitudes and understandings. Biotechnology has provoked dramatic transformations in the capabilities and conceptual approaches of the physician. But these changes were not due to technology. Deadly drugs and abortifacients were not unknown in the ancient world. And anyway, with regard to euthanasia, anyway, a blunt stone is sufficient to release a patient from enduring suffering. Yet for the Hippocratic tradition, at least as handed down through 2,000 years as the moral center of Western medicine, there was for the physician a limited prerogative over life, a prescribed practice in concord with the integrity and immanent healing powers of the human body. We were definitely not killers. Yet it is also true that the range of issues associated with advances in biotechnology go beyond the traditional domain of medicine and its long-standing moral intuitions, and they threaten both to overextend its realm and to endanger its central significance in human life. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm very much in favor of the positive dimensions of biotechnology and the new possibilities of healing. What I'm speaking to now are the dangers on the edge. As we come to see all personal frustrations and imperfections as a kind of suffering, there is an inappropriate extension of the medical model of disease and health. Following the paradigm of cosmetic surgery, this medicalization of more and more aspects of natural human life erodes our identity as physicians as a healing profession. Likewise, when the physician becomes the provider and works the will of the patient, medicine becomes an agent of a new agenda, the technological extension of human desires and dreams. Two dangers are immediately apparent. The first is the easy indulgence of the impulses of appetite, getting people what they want, giving them the kind of lives they dream of. And often it's just a trivialization of the struggle and intensity of life, softening everything that might be disruptive. This is what Nietzsche called pitiable comfort. The second, and more dangerous, is the use of biotechnology in the service of ambition, in an unbridled competition that is corrosive to community. Think Lance Armstrong using drugs to win his cycling stuff. But more deeply, there is an erosion of the connection. Even if it's not a violence to the community, it's a violence to the individual. It erodes the connection between individual effort and the ends achieved, and our concept of the continuity and integrity involved in personal life processes. As Leon Kass, former head of the President's Council on Bioethics, has written, the offer of pills and other forms of medical assistance for what are fundamentally problems of living fosters the false and enfeebling expectation that life itself has a technological solution. Yet even with these cautionary concerns in mind, one must admit it is a very difficult situation. It's difficult to know how to proceed. Certain types of non-physical suffering, for example, psychological and social troubles, loneliness, seem to be a legitimate target of medical intervention. And certain aspirations are of such serious importance or noble intent that they could justify a biomedical enhancement. For example, a surgeon might take a drug to steady his hand so he could better operate on the eye of a child. Yet at the same time, we must acknowledge that the relief of suffering is not the only or even the highest principle grounding our medical ethics. It's almost hard for us as a society to grasp this. Suffering is not the ultimate evil. The argument from suffering has no bottom. If we argue every case reaching our traditions with it relieves suffering, will never stop. It'll go all the way down. There is no end to how deep it could bury us if we argue from suffering, if we use it to justify practices that override more fundamental concerns for human dignity. Likewise, our aspirations must always be measured against the most comprehensive vision and widest wisdom concerning human purpose and human rights. Idealized personal projects transform slowly but steadily into social and political agendas. And if history is any guide, medical science can easily end up deployed in a coercive program of social engineering and social control, all in the name of a better world. And we all know, especially in the East Coast here in New York, people know very well the memory of what happened, just to pass over it very quickly. It is worthwhile pausing to reflect on the words of our fellow physician Leo Alexander. He was a key medical advisor during the Nuremberg trials and wrote part of the Nuremberg Code, which delineates principles of ethical practice for scientific experiments on human beings. He speaks of the medical profession's tragic complicity with Nazi eugenics and warns, whatever proportions these crimes finally assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they had started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude of the physicians. It started with the acceptance of the attitude, basic in the euthanasia movement, that there is such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived. We as physicians must never lose our focus and come to think we are social engineers. Our purpose is a smaller but more intense significance, the good of the individual patient placed in need before us. So we must seek a comprehensive and coherent frame for our advancing biomedical science. Central to this approach is a search for a philosophical anthropology adequate to the scientific perspectives and ethical challenges of our time. If we pause to consider the meaning of human embodiment and human dignity, we may frame and give form to our inquiry in a way that roots our reflection beyond relativism in the shared reality of our fundamental biology. We may then recognize a resonance with certain themes in the ancient ethical foundations of our medical traditions. Most significantly, the affirmation of life, the respect for the imminent well-working of the natural human body, and an acknowledgement of the reality of our frailty and finitude evident in natural aging may inform our larger reflection on the meaning of technology, the progress of civilization, and the central purposes of human life. Two issues that have been in the news in recent months can provide focus and specificity for our reflections. Both are extraordinary, yet they're off the edge. Not exactly mainstream medicine, or at least not yet, but since they are extreme, they may provide a useful heuristic for matters that are otherwise difficult to convey. The first was the announcement, actually a leak by the press, on the eve of the second International Summit on Genome Editing in Hong Kong in late November, that a young Chinese scientist had used the revolutionary new gene editing technology called CRISPR-Cas9, a very easy, cheap, and quick way to change genes. He'd used this technology to make heritable genetic alterations in two recently born little twin girls. The reaction was very strong. The alteration to a single gene that can provide some protection against infections by HIV/AIDS was done at the embryonic stage, and therefore was a germline transformation, one that could be carried over to all future generations in their family lineage. That's why the reaction was strong. It wasn't just treating a patient, it was treating a species, if you will, the future of the species. I was there in Hong Kong, by the way, and it was really an amazing moment. I mean, you felt like you're the epicenter of the human story. The drama of it felt like we turned a corner in our species history, actually in the whole history of life. For the first time in perhaps 4 billion years of life on Earth, a species was now entering into the realm of being able to change its own character. So it was quite something. The announcement was leaked ahead of the conference, and He Jung-ki was supposed to talk the second day. Well, they gave him an hour and a half, even though he was supposed to have only 10 minutes. And by that time, the world press had converged on Hong Kong, and there was a huge auditorium, maybe 900 people. And they cordoned off a whole third of the auditorium for the press, and there were these cameras with lenses that were 4 feet long, and it was just intense. And when he walked in, it was totally silent. I mean, it's like everybody knew this was an enormous moment. As soon as he got to the podium in position, the clicking started. It was so loud that it kind of overwhelmed the auditorium. They had to tell no more pictures. But it was a very dramatic moment, and I think rightfully so for those who understood it. So this was the moment. As everybody knows, this made headlines worldwide, not just because it was a sensational scientific feat, but because it seemed to open the door to a vast range of technological projects at the very foundations of human life. That's the scientist, and by the way, I know him quite well. I was supposed to go to his house for dinner at the end of the conference. I'll tell you about that later. But the reaction was varied, but some, including well-respected scientists at the summit, expressed outrage based on matters of safety, that we were rushing forward without adequate consideration of risks and long-term consequences. Others, concerned about the social and ethical implications, maintained that this opens the door for genetic engineering of so-called designer babies and even state-run eugenics programs. Still others, most specifically the transhumanists I mentioned earlier, welcomed it as a technological advance with enormous implications, not just for the cure of severe genetic diseases, but as an opportunity to rise above the cruel and contingent processes that have shaped our human origins. They saw it as a stepping stone in the technological transformation of the human future. Their sentiments echoed earlier words by Michael Lepage, feature editor at New Scientist, who expressed his assent to this agenda, writing, "It is time to challenge the idea that our genomes are somehow special and inviolable, we can do better than mindless evolution. And others pointed out that the gene alterations were a kind of human experiment with no immediate benefit to the twins, which was true. And they also pointed out the very foundations of this research involved preclinical study using human embryos. All of these concerns raise difficult and deeply serious issues, ones that we must now earnestly address within a broad-based and constructive dialogue. But while the direct therapeutic applications of germline intervention may or may not one day be widely accepted, and the transhumanist agenda of human improvement may very well prove beyond realistic reach, there is a core issue at the heart of this technological moment that has been largely ignored. It leads directly, this kind of science leads directly to the industrial scale production and instrumental use of living human embryos for purely experimental ends. Just when it seemed like the stem cell wars were fading into the distance, the embryo issue has reemerged, and with it the question of what additional projects, including those with genetically engineered human embryos, might be coming over the horizon. This arises because the era of experiments in molecular genetics, which culminated with the sequencing of the human genome, has ushered in the next logical scientific stage, the study of developmental biology, how the genes knit together the living human organism through the varied stages of development, beginning at the single cell after the fertilization of the egg, all the way up to the 50 to 100 trillion cells that make up a natural adult human body. Advances at the convergence of stem cell biology and gene editing offer us the opportunity to delete or alter one or more genes at a time, to study their role in natural human development. Likewise, we could create models to study the embryonic origins of genetic diseases or for testing new drugs. And the range of such experiments is almost endless. You could use millions and millions of embryos to do them. And it's undeniable that these experiments could supply valuable advances in scientific knowledge that we have to acknowledge. But it also raises profound ethical issues. If we now turn to recollect the reasons for our nation's serious conflict over embryonic stem cell research, we recall the enormous excitement that we were on the cusp of a revolution. The age of regenerative medicine was proclaimed. People in wheelchairs are going to get up and walk, which may yet happen, but the central argument for going forward was the relief of human suffering. That, like I said earlier, became the argument that trumped all others. The relief would be so great that we should override our nation's long-standing prohibition against federal funding of embryo-destructive research. A whole new era was beginning, offering the promise of major advances in diseases like Parkinson's disease and diabetes, and then on to all sorts of diseases. By some lights, it would involve the very conquest of aging itself. Sorry, that's a little fuzzy. Anyway, there were huge promises, you remember that. This is a video, but I don't think we're plugged into it. Maybe we didn't hook it up for sound. Anyway, what this is a political advertisement. And people come tripping out and say, well, Congressman so-and-so is getting in the way of our cures. And who's he to say who should live and die? Well, it's very violent. But it was a very difficult discussion, as everybody who was politically alert at that time knew. During this difficult national debate, I served on the President's Council on Bioethics, when in January 2002, on the first afternoon of our council's work, we met with President Bush in the West Wing of the White House. I was as deeply conflicted as the nation that we were told we were going to serve. I recognize that both sides of this debate were defending important human goods, that we were at a crucial moment in the process of scientific discovery. And yet there were serious moral and social concerns. And I wondered what principles and what perspectives on the meaning of human life would form a solid foundation for wise application of our new powers. In what follows, I want to briefly discuss the two most extreme extensions of the challenge of this era of regenerative medicine: the instrumental use of human embryos and the application of our advancing biomedicine in projects to intervene in the natural aging process. From consideration of these two bookends of human life, we may draw forth insights that can inform our overall reflection on the role of medicine in the age of biotechnology. So first, turning to the embryo and the ethical issue here. That, by the way, is an 8-cell human embryo on the sharp tip of a pin. That's how small it is. But is small a measure of moral meaning? Any evaluation, and this is the perspective I finally, after great deliberation and anguishing consideration, arrived at from my personal perspective. Any evaluation of the moral significance of human life must take into account the full procession of continuity and change that is essential for its development. With the act of conception, a new life is initiated with a distinct genetic endowment that organizes and guides the growth of a unique and unrepeatable human life. The gametes, the sperm and the egg, although alive as cells, are not living beings. They are not organisms. They are instrumental organic agents of the parents. The joining of the gametes brings into existence an entirely different kind of entity, a living human organism. With regard to fundamental biological meaning and moral significance, the act of fertilization is a leap from zero to everything. In both structure and function, the zygote, the one-celled embryo, and subsequent embryonic stages differ from all other cells or tissues of the body. They contain within themselves the organizing principle of the full development of a human being. The very word organism implies organization, an overarching principle that binds the parts and processes of life into a harmonious whole. As a living being, an organism is an integrated, self-developing, self-sustaining, self-maintaining unity under the governance of an immanent plan, something that comes forth from within itself. For an embryonic organism, this implies an inherent potency, an engaged and effective potential with a drive in the direction of the mature form. By its very nature and by its Greek name, an embryo is a developing being. Its wholeness is defined by both its manifest expression and its latent potential. It is the phase of human life in which the whole, as the unified organismal principle of growth, precedes and produces its organic parts. An embryo produces itself, if you will, just needs nurture and protection. The philosopher Robert Joyce explains, living beings come into existence all at once and then gradually unfold to themselves and to the world what they already, but only incipiently, are. To be a human organism is to be a whole living member of the species Homo sapiens, with a human present and a human future, evident in the intrinsic potential for the manifestation of the species' typical form. Joyce continues, no living being can become anything other than what it already essentially is. It is this implicit whole with its inherent potency that endows the embryo with continuity of human identity from the moment of conception, and therefore from this perspective, inviolable moral status. To interfere in its development is to transgress upon a life in process. The principle of this analysis would then apply to any entity that has the same potency as a human embryo, whether it's produced by natural fertilization or IVF or cloning or other processes. If it has this power and potential for growth and development in a human form, it is a human being. So now let's consider the implications of different view of this. To those who choose the beginnings of a road, those who choose the beginnings of a road also choose its destination. That, I think, is an old Chinese saying. Very appropriate here. If we take a different position and allow the instrumental use of human embryos in medical science, as is the case in China, in the UK, and a number of other nations, then we must come up with a well-reasoned argument for our actions and their ethical implications. Implantation, why would that be? Formation of various markers, one of them being what the embryologists call a primitive streak, first evident change and differentiation. That's not very convincing. The first functional neurologic circuit, what's privileged about that? Sentience, feeling, reflexive self-awareness, we don't even know when those start. The problem is there's a wide disagreement even among those who would allow research on human embryos. Should we use only the leftovers from IVF? Or can embryos be created specifically for research purposes? And for what kinds of projects? And how many? As I mentioned earlier, there are many, many avenues of research where human embryos could provide valuable scientific information not obtainable through animal studies. We could study the process of fertilization, implantation. We could knock out genes to study their role in development. And if we use cloning to make standardized batches of embryos, we could titrate drug levels and study the negative effects of drugs called teratogenic effects. One scientist in Japan used cloning to create 581 identical mice. Why would we not do this with human embryos? It'd be very useful for standardized scientific studies. And of course, there's the question of how far into embryological development embryos may be used to obtain cells, tissues, and organs. Already, many of the most promising therapeutic uses of stem cells involve cells taken from aborted fetuses. And over 15 years ago, scientists in Japan and Israel announced that they had taken human kidney primordia from an 8 to 10 week old aborted fetuses in plural, and implanted them into rats where they grew and formed urine-producing kidney units, a feat they described as a breakthrough that might one day save thousands of patients waiting for transplants. You get the idea that we would take fetal organs and use them in adults. And now there's a Silicon Valley biotech firm that's harvesting organs from aborted fetuses with the hope of establishing a commercial outlet for fetal organ transplantation. Of course, from a medical perspective, the ideal would be immunologically compatible fetal organs made from cloned human embryos. Would anyone favor such projects, creating embryos specifically to harvest their parts? Julian Savulescu is a physician, professor at the University of Oxford, and director of the Yuhiro Center for Practical Ethics. And I debated him in New York about 10 years ago. This is what he wrote in an article. It is morally required, he says, that we employ cloning to produce embryos or fetuses for the sake of providing cells, tissues, and even organs for therapy, followed by abortion of the embryo or fetus. Notice you create the clone embryo, you implant it in a woman, and then you abort it at the perfect moment when the tissues or organs are just at their ideal place for transplantation. And when I asked him, how far along in gestation would you allow this to go? And I asked him, 3 months? He said yes. 6 months? He said yes. 6 months. We have kids in the intensive care unit, premature babies that are under 6 months of age. But he was okay with harvesting them for their fetal organs. well, pretty amazing possibilities and pretty disturbing prospects, I'd say. I believe that anything short of affirming the inviolability of life across all of its stages, from zygote on cell embryo to natural death, is an assault on the basic dignity of human life and a violation of our professional standards as physicians. If we create and destroy human embryos for the purposes of a technological project, no matter how noble our intentions, we fracture the very foundation on which all other moral principles and practices are built. Medicine is especially vulnerable to such effects, since it operates at the intrinsically moral interface between scientific techniques and the most tender and sensitive dimensions of personal reality in the vulnerable patient. As we descend into an instrumental use of human life, we destroy the very reason for which we were undertaking our new therapies. We degrade the very humanity we were trying to heal. But if life from its conception has a sacred inviolability, and the central role of medicine is to restore and sustain the health of the patient, then what are we to say of the natural process of aging? Is aging a disease, a proper target for our advancing powers of technological control? At the marking of the creation of the Society for Regenerative Medicine, William Haseltine, head of Human Genome Sciences, stated plainly, "The real goal is to keep people alive forever." Today, in laboratories around the world, the search is on for the key discoveries that will unlock the mysteries of bodily degeneration and decline. Speculation abounds, but there are also fascinating findings suggestive of possible pathways for dramatic extension of youthful strength and overall lifespan. Simple genetic and nutritional interventions in roundworms and fruit flies have increased life expectancy by 2- and 3-fold. And similar, though less dramatic, effects have been noted in mice. Isn't that a cute little picture? And by the way, as you get more and more to larger and more complicated organisms, the effects of all this are much diminished. It's not even clear it's possible with humans, but we'll see. Moreover, and this is the second item that I mentioned, there are two news items, the study of so-called parabiosis, the joining together of the circulation of two animals, suggests that soluble factors in the blood from the young are able to activate molecular pathways that stimulate tissue regeneration. What they did was, this has been known for years and years, they sewed two animals together so that their blood circulation was joined, so that their blood flowed between both members. And the older animal actually seemed to be regenerated in some ways. I'm not sure if the younger animal got older. That would have been a logical question, but they don't talk about that. But anyway, the idea is that there might be something in blood of the young that's able to activate, stimulate regeneration. And this has led to a series of companies, of course, in Silicon Valley, where else, such as Ambrosia, founded by a Stanford Medical School graduate, not one, by the way, who took my classes. This guy started this company, Ambrosia, that offers blood from young people to be given to old people, transfusions, as a kind of elixir of youth. The recent news is that just a few weeks ago, the FDA issued a stern warning that such practices have no proven benefit and potentially significant dangers. I wouldn't do it. I mean, just think of what you don't know that you're getting, like viruses and all sorts of other things. But in any case, it does raise the question of just how far would we go to get what we want. They somehow have a picture of a whole lot of young people being tapped for their blood and being put in old people. Seems repulsive to me. Anyway, you guys decide. Anyway, it's interesting. So across a range of scientific fronts, the quest is on. Vast sums of Silicon Valley money venture capital are pouring into biotech startups fueled by both commercial self-interest and eager public expectations. I guess when you sort of lose touch with your religious foundations, there's just really no place to turn except to the material transformations of your body if you're hoping to for in a future beyond standard lifespan. So anyway, Google has started up this company called Calico. It's isn't that a clever little thing of the aging layers and sort of. Calico is aimed at the extension of human lifespan. Cambridge-trained gerontologist Aubrey de Grey, founder of the Methuselah Foundation, has dedicated his life's work to solving what he calls the perennial problem of death. We can all affirm that is a problem, but is technology the solution is the question. You have to ask Father Jonah about that. He'll tell you it's not, I think, I hope. Anyway, the argument, there's Aubrey de Grey, by the way. I debated him with the San Francisco Chronicle put on a program in the Civic Center last May, and I debated this guy in front of a huge crowd of people. And he actually says that he believes that if he can just live for 35 more years, the momentum of advances will be so great that he will live to be 1,000. Because, you know, if you can live 35 more years, then science can move even further and even further. This is what he calls longevity escape velocity, like escaping the gravity of the Earth. The farther you go, the less the gravity pulls you. So he thinks that technology will allow us to sustain our lives indefinitely. I certainly don't agree with it, even his medical analysis of it, but nonetheless, it's very seductive. People want to believe it. Of course, the argument is that the argument's made that in the last century, we saw the great extension of human life span at the turn of the century from 1899 on. Till now, the lifespan has almost doubled in our culture. And so people say, well, if life is good, then more life is better. And who could object to that in a way? But consider the following. See, what's tricky about that is that change in lifespan has not come through medical technology. It's come from other things. And there's a real difference in that. Consider the following. The advance in lifespan, which is now culminating in what appears to be an average natural limit of around 80 to 90 years. Some will live longer, some will live shorter, but generally speaking, 80, 90, maybe 100. This has come through, the advance in the last 100 years has come through intelligible operations within the natural world shaped by human understanding and human powers through improved nutrition, sanitation, and interventions against specific acute diseases. Is this a good thing, this lifespan, the natural lifespan? 8 or 9 decades is a conceptually manageable lifespan with an individual living through childhood, parenthood, and on to see his or her grandchildren, allowing a taste of each relational category. And it is a world where one's direct family lineage is connected by both genetics and personal experience, not so attenuated by time that relatives feel unrelated. You know that every time there's a new birth in the family, that child shares only half the genes with either of its parents, and only a quarter of the genes with its grandparents. And so if you go too many generations out, they're not even very genetically related, but culturally, times change, and they don't even feel like part of the same family. When I was on the President's Council, we studied these matters, and we figured out that if the average person lived to be 150 years old, and people didn't die, because obviously they had a lot of other medical interventions, keep them alive. I'll just say the average person lives 150 years. that individual newborn baby in that family would have 64 great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, 32 great-great-great-great-grandparents. You get the point. It comes out to a very large number of living relatives, too many to even know their names. So it would produce a strange social reality for sure. But think about how the natural process works right now. Generation and nurture, dependency and reciprocal generosity are in harmony of proportion. And there's a pace of journey, a coordinated coherence, a kind of meter and rhyme within the repeating cycles of birth, ascendancy, and decline. It's a balance and beauty of love and death that, however poignant, bespeaks a benevolence in the natural order. When you see your parent, your grandparents getting older and heading toward death, but they're so generous to you, there's such a beauty in it. These considerations bring us to a crucial question. What kind of knowledge is able to guide and govern our dramatic new powers over human life? Is the rationality and objectivity of our science, together with our natural inclinations and needs, sufficient to safeguard and secure the highest human good? Or is there a goodness and meaning in life that is so fundamental that it's too wide for our scientific vision and too deep to be plumbed by the imperious exigencies of natural desire? If we go with the grain and travel along the gradient of an endless series of immediate impulses, will we improve the parts and heighten the present while losing the coherence and integration of the whole of our lives? Or does the contour and constraint of natural life, our frailty and finitude, serve as a lens of a larger vision that reflects downward to give coherence and sustaining significance to all of life? In the unfolding of birth and growth, aging and death, is something evident that could not be seen outside of this drama of time? A spiritual coherence that seamlessly binds earthly life and its processes to a source and significance that at once transcends and gives purpose to the processes of the earth, lifting us to a dignity beyond all disorder, decay, and death. What I'm saying is it possible that the way we live with one another, born, generate, sustain, and die, is it possible that that drama produces in our minds an understanding of the deeper spiritual significance of life itself? Dignity beyond disorder, decay, and death. Without such a coherence between time and eternal truth, it's difficult to see how ultimately life could be anything but a process without purpose, a circumscribed project of purely private significance. Natural desire would lead us to either attempt to extend time as far as technologically possible, or to dissolve it in the involution of a ceaseless series of self-indulgent distractions, what I'm calling that playland every week or something. In Aldous Huxley's prophetic novel, Brave New World, Bernard and Lenina, how many of you have read Brave New World? For those of you who haven't, it's an assignment. So Bernard and Lenina, two of the major characters, are talking about how to spend their evening together. Lenina, typically Gigino, she says, "Let's go play electromagnetic golf." Bernard demurs and replies, "No, that would be a waste of time." And Lenina answers back, "What's time for? Time's a waste. Only aging and death remind us that time is of the deepest significance and that life is not a product but a meaningful process, a mysterious magnification of soul, a participation in matters of enduring significance that ultimately transcends time itself.